right.
It's the light, I think, from the projector.
Projector,
I suspect we'll have some more folks wander in, but I think we're going to get started because we have a packed panel and we want to leave time for questions and comments. So I'm very, very pleased to have you all come to the library forum, which is devoted to a panel discussion on Cornell Libraries International Relations. They are vast, they are wonderful, they are ongoing and developing. Last minute developments we'll be hearing about today as well. Why are we so active internationally? And I started thinking about that. One, our land grant mission. We take seriously President Scorton's charge that we serve as the land grant university to the world. And we certainly think about that in terms of the library context. Increasingly global resources are being made available digitally, and we are able to collect and bring them back to Cornell in limited amounts, and so being able to reach out to a broader community to provide those resources to our faculty and students and other researchers is a critical thing. Similarly with services, I'm most familiar with China. I've been there four times now. The first time was in 1996. It is a very different country today. And every time I go, I am just awestruck by the progress that has been made. There is much we can learn from our Chinese colleagues in leading research libraries. So technical and service innovations, I think we'll see more in the future. And also special access to collections that are privileged access that can be made available to Cornell faculty and students in through these partnerships, I think, will become increasingly important. So our panel represents a range of international projects that are underway. You will note there are three of them from the Mann Library. Each person is given 7 minutes to talk. And the Mann Library contingent is taking their 21 minutes and divided into 3 minutes to 11 minutes or something like that, and then 7. So we're going to have Gail as our principal timer. Every other person has 7 minutes to talk, so I think they've honed their discussions down. In preparing for this panel, I really wanted to have the speakers not only talk about the specifics of their projects, but to address two key questions. What are the elements of successful international collaborations? And two, what is the value these international collaborations bring to our faculty and our students? So, let me give you the lineup, and this will be in the order of their presentations. We will allow them to have their full time. Please save your questions to the end, and then we'll open it up for general questions and observations. So Mary Oakes is first. She is the director of Mann Library. She'll be speaking for 3 minutes. She's worked at Cornell Library in various roles over the last 25 years. In addition to her administrative responsibilities at Mann, Mary works with Mann's international outreach programs, which focus on improving access to scientific information for developing world researchers. She holds an MLS from Syracuse School of Information and a BS from Cornell University's College of Ag and Life Sciences. The second speaker will be Vasima Prokopska, who is the International Projects Librarian at Mann Library. She is the project director for the Essential Agriculture Library, TEAL, which she'll talk about today. She also travels periodically to Africa. I understand you're leaving on Tuesday to go?
Yeah.
To provide information literacy training to PhD students in the African Centers for Crop Improvement. She is currently involved in designing TEAL and Research for Life training workshops in collaboration with IPOCA, the Information Training and Outreach Center for Africa, and IDF, the Institute of Development Studies in the United Kingdom. She's keenly interested in developing information literacy programs for users living in emerging countries. She is one of the two peripatetics here today and works remotely from the West Coast. Jaron Porcello, is that how I say it? Has worked with MAN's international program since 2007. Her current activities include serving a three-year term on the board of, here's another acronym, IAALD, the International Association of Agricultural Information Specialists, and chair of the training team for the Research for Life Partnership. In 2008 and 2009, she co-designed and taught an intensive two-week scientific writing and research course for PhD scholars at the University of Ghana. Thomas Mills graduated with a BA in International Political Economy from Northwestern University and an MA in International Affairs Finance from Columbia University. He received his JD, magna cum laude, from the University of Illinois College of Law, where he was a visiting assistant professor and also served as the director of the graduate and international programs at the College of Law. While teaching at the University of Illinois, he earned another master's degree in education and library and information science, two degrees actually. At Cornell, Mr. Mills teaches advanced legal research in international and foreign law, online legal research, and team teaches lawyering. Greg Green has been the curator of the John M. Eccles Collection on Southeast Asia since 2006. He has previously held similar positions at Northern Illinois University and Arizona State University. Greg has been involved in international projects since he began working in libraries in 2001. He played a key role in establishing the Southeast Asia Digital Library and maintains a strong interest in collaborative digital projects. And last but not least, Xin Li has been working with Chinese libraries over the past 5 years. Her primary role is to identify opportunities that support CUL's strategic direction, to build professional relationships and make CUL visible. She's been living in Taiwan with her family since August. There is a lot for her to learn, including the complex landscape and culture for collaboration, working in two time zones, and how to deal with typhoons and earthquakes. Ithaca has only trained her for snowstorms. And I learned once we turn to daylight savings time, we'll now be 13 hours difference rather than just the 12. So Mary, I'm going to turn it over to you.
So I used up at least 10 seconds getting out of my chair. Okay, now I have my part of this presentation is really an introduction to some of the programs at MAN. And Vasima and Jaron are going to give you the meat of this presentation. But I'd like to talk a little bit about the philosophy behind our programs. And Anne already mentioned President Scorton's view that Cornell is the land-grant university for the world, or a land-grant university for the world. And we've basically run under that philosophy all the years that I've worked at MAN Library, starting with Jan Olson, who began some of these programs in the early 1990s. And we really work in three areas. We partner with faculty to enhance what they're already doing. So two examples of that project are the African Center for Crop Improvement, where we help with working with the PhD students that are based in Africa training to be PhD plant breeders for African crops. We also work with the Durable Rust Resistance in Wheat Project funded by the Gates Foundation. And in that project, we've helped them get access to e-books that they can put up online for all of their projects. So with each project, it depends on working with faculty to enhance a project that they are putting together. We also work with some of the College of Ag and Life Sciences dual degree programs. So there are two programs in particular, one at Tamil Nadu in India, and another one at Bahir Dar University in Ethiopia. And for those, both of those programs, the students there are treated just like any other Cornell student. So they simply become another client of Mann Library, although they're a little farther away than the typical campus student here. The third aspect of our work really focuses on improving access to scientific information in the developing world. It started with Teal in the 1990s. It moved on from there to Agora, which was an online program that we worked on with the FAO, and Vasima and Jaren are going to talk more about those programs. But Agora then led to collaboration with other UN agencies, WHO and the UNEP, United Nations Environment Program, and expanded into three sister programs called Research for Life. So Anne asked, what makes a successful collaboration? I think it requires that you're working with partners that are committed to the same cause that you are. And in working with the developing world, I think it's important to remember that it's not about you. It's about building capacity on the ground. And sometimes I get some grief because Cornell doesn't get a whole lot of credit for working on Agora. But we really are, if you can be the underpinnings of something without taking a lot of credit, that really helps a lot in some of these partnerships. So I will hand it off to Bettina.
So in my allotted time, I'll be talking about the Essential Electronic Ag Library, and it's quite commonly known in the African subcontinent as FAL, that's our branding, or TVVAL. During my section of the presentation, you will see three logos at the top. FAL, of course, our logo, ITOCA and CTA, and I'm going to explain why they are there very briefly. As Mary mentioned, in international programs, it is extremely important to work with other partners on the ground who believe in the same vision as our program. And the two partners who do work very closely with us in fulfilling the vision for Essential Electronic Ag Library or Agricultural Library are ITOCA and CTA. ITOCA is the Information Training and Outreach Center for Africa, and CTA is based in Netherlands, and its English translation of its acronym is the Center for Technical Cooperation for Agriculture and Rural Cooperation. So you see their logos throughout. What is FAL? It is a digital collection of research journals for agriculture and related sciences. I'm reading this because it is it took hours to come up with this. I don't want to be called upon for changing it. Researchers, students, faculty, and librarians can discover and access thousands of full-text PDF articles without the use of the internet. So it is a completely offline resource. Doesn't need the internet, does need power. FAL is available to institutions in income-eligible countries. What are these income-eligible countries? They are based on World Bank guidelines, and they can be found on our website. Otherwise, I'll take up all my time. This is FAL, really. I don't know if people can see at the back. This is a 1 terabyte hard drive. The 250 journals that we have fit on this hard drive, and it is shipped out to its end user. Basically, this is FAL. It's produced at Mann. It consists of over 200 of the important, most essential ag journals starting from 1990s. It works completely offline, no internet required. We have agreements with the publishers that we will only provide content with an embargo of 1 year at a time. Therefore, the 2009 content is being added in the 2010 update, which will be released at the end of this year. It is a permanent part. The wonderful thing about this is that if the subscription are not continued, we don't take this back from the subscriber institution. It's theirs to keep. So that's the wonderful asset that they can have. And publishers make it possible by donating generously to this product. YTunes is still very young in many countries. My very recent travel to Africa still confirms the fact. We may imagine that it is there in many places, but it's still very young. Internet connectivity is even still very inconsistent. And the value of this product is over $1 million, and it's offered at anywhere between $3,000 to $5,000 depending upon funding availability. So this is the cost of TEAL. Every year it is updated with additional 1 year content, as I mentioned, and that costs $525 to the end user. This is how TEAL began. I have to say one very, very wonderful thing about TEAL. Every project manager I think I know is still involved with this project. So you can see how hard it is to let go of TEAL. It's everybody's baby. Karen, Mary, Nicole, who's not here in this room, and now I. So everyone stays with TEAL. That baby grew up to be this one. So there you go. That little disc that's sitting next to him, she used to be a stone computing operator for many years at now. And that's TEAL. I'll leave you with three facts, because it's such a short presentation, I thought I had to boil down things into three facts that you can basically take away with you. How many sets are placed in the world? Around 268 sets are placed around the world. The largest percentage of sets, this graphic may be very small, so it's Kenya, which has about 12%, Nigeria, Iraq, before all the crisis situations occurred, we had placed a lot more. We have a lot of work to do still. And Nigeria is where I'm traveling next, so hoping to drum up a little more business there. And of course, 44%, the biggest piece of this pie, is in many different countries all over the world with less than 5 sets in each country. Fact 2. So how many of these subscribers are we able to keep up to date? As you heard me, the set is updated every year with the content of the previous year. Right now we have 58% of TEAL subscribers up to date, which is a really good conversion rate. And the legend on the right hand side shows you the 15 different iterations that TEAL went through, starting with the CD Tower version in 1997, all the way till the 2008 update on this hard drive, which we call LAN. So it is hard to convert people from, from an older version, but as you can see, very, very few subscribers now have the CD version, which is the tower of CDs, and we are working harder and harder on getting them up to date. How do we manage to do it? With help of funding agencies, and that's why you saw CTA's logo. CTA, the Center for Technical Cooperation in Agriculture and Center for Technical and Cooperation in Agriculture is our biggest funder there. 101 sets have been directly funded by CTA. And rest of the funders, you can see they're funding different permutations and combinations. Rockefeller Foundation was next a long time ago, I think, especially during its inception. So those are the three facts, 268, 58, 101. So you can take those figures away. Bonus fact, I cannot get off my time allotted without thanking the people. First and foremost, we have to thank the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that keeps this project going. They funded a grant of $1.8 million that covers TEAL production costs and staff salaries. We don't fund TEAL sets directly to institutions, but then we had CTA come to our rescue. The TEAL team, Jennifer Gibson, who worked at Olin, has now moved to TEAL production. Nicole, who was, I think, was a second project manager, she is still continuing, and she is based in Costa Rica and covering the Latin American Caribbean region for us. I am the current project manager, Mary, I think, was the first. And Erica Rennes, who is our Client and Outreach Relations Coordinator. And Melissa, who is our web designer. She's here at the back. And I want to specially thank Jaren, who was the outgoing TIL project director, and she facilitated a very, I think, a very effective and smooth succession plan for the project. So, at mentioning Jaren, I'd like to hand over the stage to Jaren.
Thank you,
I have 11 minutes, but it's not all just me talking, which is nice. I am going to share a video clip, actually. But first, the two things that I would like to talk about are Agora, which both Mary and Bettina have mentioned, and I'm sure many of you have heard about Agora. Mary has been involved with Agora since 2003. She is one of the founding partners of the program. And Agora was started in 2003. Agora stands for Access to Global Online Research for Agriculture. It's a program for institutions, as Bettina mentioned, in eligible countries. The eligibility countries for both TIL and Agora are very similar, although they're not an exact replication. Program eligibility for Agora is also based on country GNI or GDP. And it's basically available for institutions to receive low cost or free access to a collection of almost 2,000 top-notch scientific and agricultural journals. So with that preface, I'd like to go ahead and share this video with you that talks a little bit more about the impact that Agora has had on farmers in Burkina Faso.
And they did it with the help of Agora, developing microdoses of fertilizer, a more efficient but also more labor-intensive method, which produces a higher yield.
In the beginning, we found that the work was harder than the old method. But when we saw the results, we realized the microdose is better, so we used it. Now that we are familiar with it, we think it's even easier to use than the old fertilizer.
Achieving food security for the more than 1 billion hungry people will depend on sustainable increase in agricultural production. These increases will be achieved through the application of new technologies. Many of these are available in the vast body of literature generated by the world's agricultural science community.
Even Michelle, who admits initial skepticism, was won over. With microdoses, we have a much better harvest than with our traditional methods. Agora is one of the biggest portals for agricultural journal access. With just a click of the button, the electronic library searches keywords, providing constant updates and new ideas. As a technology partner, Microsoft provides a platform for access and authentication, able to perform at the same level as today's most heavily trafficked websites.
Science research has been available for a long time. It's been, since the beginning of time. The problem is access to leading science research has not been available. And that's what the UN saw as a real niche, that they could then bring together the publishers, the science journal publishers, get some support from the universities, bring their connections to the developing countries, and promote access.
In addition to agricultural information, the Research for Life initiative provides research across health sciences and the environment. Agora has expanded the boundaries of access to agricultural information, resulting in innovative solutions and improved productivity and household incomes, giving many of the world's poorest citizens a better life and a better future.
So yeah, that was we got our logo at the end of the video, which was really good because Cornell does play a major role in this program. So just first, the video originally aired in mid-September on CNBC and PBS on the World Business Report, and now is available sort of on YouTube for both the Research for Life channel as well as those other programs. One of Cornell's major roles that we play in Agora is actually working with the different publishers to solicit basically the journal content that is available in Agora. So there's over nearly 2,000 journals that are available in Agora now, and we do most of the communication back and forth with the publishers to solicit the content. And I think that this is a good opportunity to kind of discuss one of the important partnerships, or what makes a successful collaboration. And it is the willingness of partners. So we're typically on the other side of seeing constant inflation of publishing material. And I do have to give credit to publishers here, because for both TL and Agora, all of the content is donated by the publishers free of charge, so that people around the world can get access to it. So we have a very different view, I think, of how publishers can interact with these programs and how they can make their content available. So much of the content that is available in Agora, as I said, is top-notch scientific journals and access to databases like Scopus. So the quality of material that's available there is very, very, very high. So administratively speaking, I'm kind of stepping outside the Agora camp and looking at the overall Research for Life components, which is composed of two other content portals, Canary, which is for health, and Awari, which is for environment. The Research for Life team is composed of many sort of informal partnerships and affiliations. And one of these partnerships is the training team for Research for Life. that I'm currently involved with. And I think it speaks very highly to kind of all of the different initiatives that Research for Life makes available. As Cecilia mentioned, she's working with the Information Training and Outreach Center in Africa, LATOCA, which provides the majority of training for librarians and end users in sub-Saharan Africa for the Research for Life program. And today, ITOCA has reached over 2,500 librarians through their training the trainer model that they do. And what the Research for Life training team does is to coordinate with people throughout the world, ITOCA, other institutions, people of all kinds of different affiliations who are able to travel and provide training to librarians as well as end users throughout the world. There's typically 15 to 20 trainings that take place on behalf of Research for Life Center each year. All right, so I've just been given the 1 minute time warning signal. And so I do want to just mention that one of the, I guess, most important elements, I think, of successful international collaboration is to really work closely with your on-the-ground partners. Because international projects they can run the risk of maybe overshadowing what is taking place on the ground. So developing those partnerships and relationships with people who are already working on the ground is extremely important. The very last project that I do want to mention is EAL, the International Association of Agriculture Information Specialists. And the reason that I want to mention EAL is because in July 2013, Cornell will be hosting the World Congress for EAL. And this will be, I think, a great opportunity for us to see librarians and researchers from all over the world come to Cornell and really discuss an array of issues that are facing librarianship kind of as a whole. And there will be more information coming out about this conference in 2011.
Engagement at Cornell Law Library, one thing leads to another, to show you how projects are just built upon themselves as we do it. And we talk about two projects, starting with Nuremberg going into the International Criminal Tribunal of Rwanda, and then work with Liberia. It all started about 5 years ago. We put up in-house an analysis of the personality of Hitler. I knew that Harvard had a copy and they had been working with their collection. I wanted to beat them. So we put it up, and it ended up a couple days after being launched on the internet. We were getting 30,000 hits a day, and I was doing interviews on the phone around the world. It got us a lot of attention for our collection. And so the next thing we did, we put up a detailed index of the documents we have. The collection itself consists of testimony, but we also have about half of the 150 volumes are unique or never before seen top secret documents from the trials. Based on the traffic, we got a grant from the Lapkin Foundation to digitize and start putting up digital documents and linking them. And this is a chart from our staff tracker for the last week or so, you can see, and it has been consistent use over the past 4 or 5 years. And I must say, we couldn't have done any of this without DCAPS. Thank you very much, DCAPS, and everybody who works there. And here's a map that I captured. It shows that the hits are coming from all over the world, obviously the United States and Europe. But here, South America, Asia, we've had them in China, we've had them from all over the world. And through the power of Google,
the ICTR, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, found us. The court is closing in a couple of years, and they wanted to work it out how to preserve the legacy. It's something that they hadn't thought of, and the importance of the court itself. It has set a lot of important international legal precedent, especially rape as a weapon of war, etc. And through Google, this is the Google search they found us. They come after some little school in Cambridge, and they found our site, clicked on it, and came and visited us twice. And then my director, Claire Domain, and I, and Stuart Pachevsky from ILO, were invited to ICTR in June as official consultants for the UN to help them with these issues. We had meetings to share information and ideas, so we were getting ideas and information from them as well, which helped inform us on how we can help them. One of our big roles was meeting with the judges about their personal papers. The judges themselves have never thought of their papers as being an important asset for the future and as a part of the legacy of the court. And so we met with each judge to talk to them personally to try and convince them. Some had concerns for their own safety. The woman in the brown there, that's Judge Bosa from Uganda, and she was worried about her own safety. But the idea that, you know, it could be a dark eye car up to a certain point. All these ideas they hadn't thought about. And another large portion of the reason we were there was to raise the profile of the ICTR. The ICTY for Yugoslavia is well known in the literature. There's a lot published. ICTR, less so. So along those lines, we had the Chief Justice Dentist, Sir Dennis, who's third person from the year right, came and spoke at our Avon symposium last spring. And we've had other activities and opportunities growing out of this. We met with the East African Court of Justice, East Africa Law Society, there about the idea of getting their publications more widely spread in the United States. The Court of Justice had a brand new librarian who knew nothing about international law, helping him on resources and how to help his court, visiting scholars coming to Cornell. Sir Dennis has been here, and then other possible joint projects in the future. The other, quickly, is the Library and Law Project. There, that also, we have a long history at Cornell with Professor Convince, who is both ILR and law, started in the mid-50s the Liberian Recodification Project, rewriting the laws and writing their Supreme Court reports and published here. And Claire's predecessor, Jane Hammond, actually set up the law library in Monrovia. Civil War breaks out, N79, everything is destroyed. Specifically, libraries were targeted to destroy. Nothing was there. Because of our history, I put up here a typical request, and I get requests from the UN, State Department, people pro se trying to represent themselves, NGOs from around the world, because they know we're one place that you can get the law, even though it is not up to date, because a lot of law has been passed, they can get something. And this came from the U.S. Embassy in Monrovia. And this is a nice letter I received. This is Antonio Dollar, who was in the U.N. Mission in Liberia, trying to set up the election. And she sent me an email saying, could you send me the election law? We do not have the law. And so I scanned it, sent to her, and she emailed it back. You don't realize what you've done. We have nothing to go on. So just even trying to help bring the country back together and stability. So we built a website, more of a portal with more information, but we also put in, we have our digitized collection of laws there. We actually have the legal history of Liberia at the law library from the 1840s forward, and we digitized the earliest stuff. It was conserved at the lab in Olin and digitized at the same time, and the first four dots we can get to this collection, like I said, is unique. It doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. And then with the last one, we put up a sample of the code to show potential donors what we can do to get the law out there. The UN, State Department, everybody had expressed interest in actually helping to pay for this. One problem, though, was that there was copyright claim to part of it. And so, obviously, that threw them off the runs and things. Then we put up an index of Liberian law reports, which is heavily used. Volume 1 through 27, volume 28 through 41 had the copyright claim on it. Here's the sample of the code that we put up with the help of DCAPS. This is the president of Liberia, of the University of Liberia, Hamid Dennis, came and spoke to us about, because he knows about this project, about establishing relationships with the law school and the University of Liberia. And basically the idea of looking for other opportunities through these projects, resources, collections, what can we do with our collections, professors' papers. I work with our development office up alumni donations. We actually got the Nuremberg collection through an alum. Lapkin is through a connection of an alum. Organizing the archives, that's ICTR, and also establishing partners on all different levels to try and leverage what we do have and get the information out there in an electronic age. And I think that's the goal of what we're doing. And additional benefits, you know, raises the profile, creates opportunity for our development office, engages with our alumni, and gives us publishing opportunities as well. And that's it.
I also have a couple of projects to talk about. The first is the virtual, we were calling the Virtual Southeast Asia Project. This is a project to create a virtual world / role-playing game / digital library mapping interface all in one. And that should be fun. Both projects I've been working on are in their infancy, although I've been working on them, imagining them for several years now. This particular project is set up so that it will, the plan is to have it interact with existing digital libraries and pull content from these digital libraries and pull it into the game. So examples of the libraries we're working with are the Southeast Asia Digital Libraries, Southeast Asia Visions, the C-Site Culture and Language Site, and then also a certain amount of new content will also be created where necessary within the game. Each, and this slide in particular, Anne mentioned new developments. This one's going to look quite a bit different from what actually we're talking about even in the last few days. But we're working on a game that will contain different levels, and the levels contain mini-games within each level, and advancement quizzes and such you can read there. But basically, it starts with an interface that works on a map of Southeast Asia, and then gets more specific as you get into the game, down through the country level, provinces and states, cities and towns, and down into specific sites. And so the players will, as they progress through the game, get more specific into the information, and also then be able to move back and forth throughout the levels. And we started out calling this a museum, but as players play this game, they will then collect information. We thought it was going to be a museum at first, but that's changed. What I've done is I've hired a group of students, and they are really driving the how we're building this game. And so they thought having a research dossier rather than a museum would better collect the information about the region. And the idea behind it is that someone comes, it's really a game where the idea is now that there's a group of aliens coming down to contact Earth, and before they make contact with Earth, they want to research as much as possible to make sure that we're not dangerous to them. And so this particular game is dealing with the unit that is sent down to study Southeast Asia. And so they collect all this information and return it back to their alien bosses. And so that's the idea behind it. The next project here is the Southeast Asian Newspaper Archive. And the issue with this is that print newspapers from Southeast Asia, as you see here, they're slow to arrive. They're very expensive to ship, to house, to preserve, and they're difficult to use for research in their print formats or even in microform formats. So the goal here is to establish a digital archive of newspapers from Southeast Asia and to preserve them in the future. This shows the current route of how these newspapers arrive here, starting with electronic files from the publishers that go to printers that then are sent out, and our vendors from various countries collect them, send them to us, and then we process them, store them, reformat them, and store them again, and that all ends up in the hands of the information seekers. And all of these steps along the way cost money. The idea behind this is to cut out a lot of those steps and go straight from publishers' files into a digital archive that can then store and serve these out to the information seekers in a way that's much easier to work with than the print files, the print papers. The only way we can make this work is to make it cost either the same or less than what it costs currently. And so we're looking at the cost of what it takes now and what it would take to set up the digital archive and comparing those. And then once we've proven that we can do this for the same or less money, then we'll be moving forward. And we're at that point where we're moving beyond that. And so this is a project that has partners. Our main partner in this is the Library of Congress, and their offices in Southeast Asia. And also we'll be working with different newspaper publishers around the region. And we set it up so that the Library of Congress really works with the publishers directly, and then we work to maintain and build the archive. And we'll go back there. Talking about some of the methods to create a successful partnership, successful collaboration, I think for these projects, and I wasn't able to go into a lot of the details with the time allotted, but it takes a lot of patience and imagination because there will be a lot of roadblocks that come up to stop the project cold at any point in its life. And so it's a matter of building these things slowly over a number of years before they actually come to fruition and you can start seeing some finished product. And also, one thing that's been mentioned are all the great partners internationally. There's also, and I think some of the most important partners are here within the library system. These things aren't created in a vacuum in one unit or another. It takes a lot of work around the library system to build an international project. And that's one thing that really is important to getting it getting off the ground. And so that's all I have.
Okay, I'm going to talk about China. Okay, I have 7 minutes as well. I'm going to, because Anne already mentioned she is most familiar with China, some of you have heard about some of the things I'm going to list. However, what I will try to do is to give you an update to talk about where we are. Why in China? A select set of libraries is very, very hot. These are the top-notch libraries. These two pictures are taken from Tsinghua last year. We don't often see lines outside of the library waiting for the library to open in the rain. another thing when I tour around the top-notch libraries, especially in Beijing and Shanghai, is that the government is invest very heavily in the libraries, not only facilities, collections, digitization, and everything. Out of these investments and the library being visited by many, many users, come the innovation, how to do, you know, user services. We have very shared environment in Cornell and, you know, at Tsinghua or Beijing University. We're trying to do similar things, moving towards speed, providing user and, you know, fast services and customization, so on and so forth. This is the major reason why we're in China. And you've heard Tsinghua many times. And we have been right now doing, I want to give the complete credit to Liren Zhen, who is the Watson curator. He is behind the scenes for Cornell working on the joint library resource website for the Chinese studies. And the division of labor is Tsinghua is responsible to do the technical part. Plus, they will provide their digital content that they have. And they will digitize what we said is going to be valuable for Cornell. And Cornell will provide the content we have. For instance, we have some photographs that are complementing to the textual resources that Tsinghua has. And we will, you know, upload these onto the website. We will provide a list of faculty here and their research interests, so that Tsinghua will provide their comparable list of faculty and their research. And then a virtual community will start to form. And somebody among the speakers talked about access. Partnership is about access to things you would otherwise not have. For instance, this could be print resources, this could be digital. And Tsinghua and some other Chinese libraries have a lot of things digitized. They are not a copyright issue, however, it's a regulation issue. The government will say, you know, these are Cultural Revolution documents that I don't want to have it yet released to others. And this is when the on-site access is very valuable for our researchers. And another thing I want to stress is the power of networking. Without Tsinghua, we cannot get many, many other, you know, people in China. And for instance, last week, actually yesterday, Tsinghua had somebody delivered the million book file, that is Nan's book, that got digitized in China 4 years ago, to John Ferreira, who is in Beijing. We looked for it all over and couldn't find it. Thanks to Tsinghua, we found them. It gets delivered to John. John is bringing them back. We are doing other things that is using the network, you know, Tsinghua has to expand Cornell's efforts, such as Euclid. We are actively taking subscribers. We already completed all the stages of negotiations, so on and so forth. I'm not going to talk about staff training and exchange because we already have people visiting each other. And one thing that we just began to do is we are going to co-organize a 2012 Chinese and American University Librarians Forum in Beijing. This is in honor of the centennial of Tsinghua University Library, but the theme is to explore a transnational perspective of the 21st research library. And another often mentioned partner is the Chinese National Science Library. I'm going to use NSL as a shorthand. The vision of the director is library will gradually to be digital, and the library's role will be in the center of the knowledge collaboratory. This is his wording. And he's developing some very interesting, you know, services. For instance, he has a group of people, staff, that is informatics, subject librarians, and also IT, that they are providing information analysis service that periodically, every month, provide updates and trends to their researchers. This is a library that only has graduate students and above, no undergraduates because of their institution. And they basically say, here is the niche for Chinese to get ahead. Here is the well-mature research area. These are the important players in Asia and Europe. you should work them. And so that's what they are doing, and they are doing a lot of tools. I tried to do a screenshot to show you. This is one of the locally developed tools that pull free things on the web and subscribe materials. They have widgets for their users to customize. And these are the things. It's a library that's very big in open access. And some of them can be perhaps readily adopted by us. Others could perhaps inspire us to do similar things. And they are participating in a 2050 planning for science, you know, what the science and technology challenge will be for the nation. And these are the things that we are working on with them. Where Dean and John Forsen-Reichert will jointly seek funding to internationalize VIVO, and they will share with us what I just mentioned, and they will share findings with us of their information analysis. They are interested in archive DCAPs and VIVO and digital preservation, and Oya was just there last week, and she can tell more about it. With China, we are also doing a purchasing plan pilot, which is very much like the approval plan. Where we are is the vendor has subcontracted University of Hong Kong Library to do cataloging. Scott, the cataloger, already reviewed the sample records, was happy with the quality. And tomorrow, right, Scott, I'm meeting with them to go over each workflow to set up our expectations. And Columbia is very interested in this, so now it's a two-core exploration. Ask about value. I think whether in China or in elsewhere, it's the same. What we do in Ithaca or in China is to make the better teaching research and scholarship. I'm not going to repeat some of the things that my previous colleagues already said. You have to have shared vision and willingness. And you need to have a certain level of trust that does not always come easy. It takes years to build. And then there's culture and language barriers as well. And it is a very crowded, field. I read something in Columbia's news the other day. A professor said, the future of education is location agnostic. I think the library will need to have a transnational perspective, and the partnership is a wonderful area to look into. And I took this picture. I took it with Lira when we visited one of the companies providing cataloging and technical services. Stanford was there. Their university librarian put their flag in their office area. I thought it's funny to show all of you. Thank you.
So can we turn off this light so that you all can come back and be part of the panel? Play projector off. Great. So, wow. I think the breadth and scope of what we're doing is just incredible. And I want to thank our panelists for sharing what they're doing. And now I want to invite you all to offer your comments and questions for them. So, questions. Ed?
I have kind of some awareness of all of these things, but it's just terrific to have it laid out like this. It's a great program, and I really appreciate having the opportunity to hear this laid out in the way it was. It's impressive, even if you have a sense of what's been going on, to hear it.
Did you all hear the question? Gail said she was really impressed by all this stuff. And she also asked about the opportunities for other library staff to get involved in these projects or other international efforts. So I'm going to turn to my panelists, and then I have a few things I could say about that as well. So, Jerry, why don't you start?
Oh, okay. So thanks for the question. So I think there's a few different opportunities to get involved with the projects that I discussed. So the Research for Life team, as I said, is an informal partnership. So there's a lot of different teams that actually work on that. For instance, Adam Chandler helped at one point with disease statistics because of his expertise. There's training teams to get involved with. So really, I think it's, at this point, it's a matter of getting in touch. If there's any area of training, usage, PR, marketing, areas where you'd like to lend your expertise, I'd love to hear from you. The other project, the FEOL World Congress Conference, is coming up in 2013. I think it would be a great opportunity for other FEOL staff to get involved again in a number of different primary classes. And when they come out, there'll be a little bit more information about those in 2011. Yes, the information will be available in 2011 for the conference in 2013, because we will be hosting a major international conference. And there's all kinds of ways to get involved in the on-the-ground type of logistics to do more back-end type of coordinating.
Could you just clarify that's happening here?
That's happening here at Cornell 2013.
So one thought I had, there's been some discussion of developing a social science program along the lines of the Inari Agora Olari Medical Agriculture Environment. And certainly Cornell would be in a good position to assist with a social science program. And if there are folks that are interested in that, I'm happy to talk more with you and then put you in touch with some of the other people that are working on that. That's one thing that immediately comes to mind.
For me, I think it would be wonderful if somebody says, I'm interested in that. It's easier to find. But for instance, you could also initiate as a content expert. My first meeting this time is with Bana. We were having a cup of coffee. She said, gee, I wonder whether we have the top 10 composers of Japan and China in our collection. And this is something that she would talk with Liren and then would be useful if the three of us get together. See, that's a content aspect that I wouldn't even have thought of. And that alone starts something. I know when I go to China or Japan, and first of all, of course, Liren would be involved, Dan would be involved, and Bana, then there is a form of a group that work on some very concrete things. There would be also general things like, how did you get started? I would be very, you know, willing to talk about. I just fell into it because I'm Chinese. So, but other than that, there will be things that growing out of it. Start to prioritize what kind of awareness of culture you get. All of these will make you ready for get really hands-on. And so it's a scale between specific ones like Bono ones to a more general one, test and then move into. That's my reaction.
I think the second, those thoughts, just come talk to us if you're interested in any specific aspects of any of these projects, and there's always work to be done. And also, or if you have ideas for your own projects, we can certainly help you figure out what might be the issues that would get in the way of the success and try to help work around them. But also specifically with some of mine, with the game, if you're interested in being a game tester as we get this going, we'll have a pilot part of this done towards the end of this year or end of the spring semester. That is one of our goals there, so we can start testing parts of it if you're interested in that. Certainly get hold of me. Otherwise, I'll get hold of you if there's some sort of expertise that you might offer, and I think you can help out. So
especially you gamers, right?
So in my case, I guess it was serendipity how I got involved in international projects. I initially started doing work naturally in India because that's where I was, am from. And then TEAL happen. But there are two aspects to my job. One is the TEAL project management, and the other is a very, very broad brush called international projects. So it's, in both cases, anybody who is interested either in training in other countries, especially in Africa where we have a lot, anybody with Spanish skills, because we are trying to do more outreach in Latin America, and we can actually train in Spanish. And also, what I didn't have time to talk about was the Gates milestones, because when Gates Foundation gives money, they have a lot of expectations that we meet several milestones. So there are a lot of different opportunities there. I'm not going to say more than I'm going to check in with Mary. But, yes, anything, please contact her. Thank you.
I think, hopefully the message of what I was saying is that there's a lot of resources here within the collection to look for ideas on how to capitalize what's here and build. Both of these projects that I talked about started out small, and just capitalizing and looking out for ideas on how to expand, how to basically, the basic idea is to have access to what we have here with, for the world. But then going along with that is our expertise that we have within the system, because there's a lot of need, as everybody I think on the panel has, you know, said, there's a lot of need out there around the world. And so I guess my message would be to find something within the vast collections that we have here, and to develop an idea. It might start small and then just keep working on it to the Donovan collection. And both of these, I mean, I've been working on it for 5 years. And in the very beginning, it was, you know, just very little me in my office. And then it just starts and grows from there.
I also wonder whether the Professional Development Committee would like to think about whether there is interest in maybe an international interest group of some sort. And for the librarians and archivists in the crowd, there are research professional development leave possibilities. They're all under CUL Procedure 14. And also Fulbright offers programs for international exchange for not only for doing research, but also for working directly with other professionals within various countries, and it includes librarians and archivists as well. I have a question for you, Thomas. In terms of the Rwanda Tribunal records, what is actually going to happen to them?
There's no decision been made right now. It's a very political question, because Rwanda would like them back. They see it as part of Rwandan history. However, there's a fear if it goes to Rwanda, it will be destroyed.
Uh-huh.
It is currently in Arusha, Tanzania. They would like it to, Tanzania and Arusha would like it to stay there, because it has really greatly contributed to the economic development of the town and the area. The Hague has volunteered to build a brand new building for an archive of this. However, you know, colonialism, the colonial past and everything, and so that one people are really like, we don't think so. The UN has, for the most part, woken up to the idea that, yes, this needs to be preserved, but they want the money, the cost. And they have a campus in Nairobi, and so they're thinking that, let's put it in Nairobi. So there's tugs and pulls all over the place. And within this, too, is when we were there, they were starting to redact the videos and the testimony to protect the witnesses. And part of it is, you know, the discussion we were having, is it 50 years, 75 years? You know, 75 years out, well, I saw you, my great-grandfather, and you testified against him, etc. And so all these issues, the idea of, okay, maybe the answer is multiple, having the original someplace, but multiple places for access, but then having standard policies throughout. So it's a very political question, and also the money question, and has been yet to be decided.
Thank you.
do you see a role for Cornell in there at all?
The one possible thing that we talked about was actually the judges' papers, mm-hmm. because the judges individually will decide where those papers would be. And we said that we could do a dark archive here of their papers under their terms. And Stuart Bisheski, as we talked about what they do at Keele, and showed him the forms and the procedures that are used, and said that we could house them here, and then at some point in the future, you know, they're opened, they're returned to the original archives, something along those lines.
To try to get some sort of understanding of the place and also work with people on the ground, people who know what they're talking about. With this game in particular, I'm building something that represents Southeast Asia, so if there's something in there that causes people to upset people, it could be very difficult. So I'm working with the students that I've hired on here are from around the region and have expertise and they grew up in these areas. So that's one way that I'm trying to alleviate that to a certain degree, but also realizing that at some point lots of different opinions out there, and you can't please everybody.
Anybody else?
I just, one thing is listen. Going in and listening as opposed to coming in and talking. The first thing is to listen to understand how it is that we can help. That's the first meetings we had at the ICTR, so that we could listen and understand our role, and then build off of that. And being flexible, the Liberian project, where initially I had envisioned us digitizing the laws here, and doing the work here, just in the past 3 weeks has changed quite a bit, and they want to build capacity in Monrovia, so they build the skill set and eventually be able to take something, you know, take it over in 10, 15 years. And it makes perfect sense to me, so I don't have any resistance to that. What is our role? How can we help you, though, now, given that objective? And so it's listen and be flexible.
I just want to mention one thing. I'm in Taiwan. I should be in my own culture. But it is difficult because I just had my first success. I had my business card on the flip side in Chinese. The first success is I had enough tea in the past 3 months for one librarian to tell me, you know, your title, you know, the Assistant University Librarian for Strategic Initiatives. That translation of the word strategic, which always works in mainland China, reminds the Taiwanese of the war they have been preparing with mainland China since 1949.
I'm like, oh boy.
So I came back and asked Tiffany to order a new set. I said, what word would fit the word strategic initiative that does not remind you of the war? And they gave me a different word. I'm talking about Chinese. But it is my success because I started making cold calls to librarians, you know. And after 3T, she feels she has a personal relationship to tell me that word was awful.
So, I must say it's been wonderful to travel to China with Xing Li because I always perk up when she says, with all due respect, Anne, she's going to tell me something about you.
I guess that just leaves me. So I'll just say that when I started with India, I will admit that I was very much very comfortable working in my own culture. But going to Africa is still very different, so I'm no expert at that culture. But the one thing that keeps helping me is that I do remember that when I grew up and went all the way to grad school in India, access to information was still a problem. And that same reminder for me, I keep superimposing it on my experience in Africa, because even though today we think of India as a far more information-rich environment, I don't remember growing up that way. So that is pretty much the memory I take with me, and that puts me into perspective.
So we are out of time, unfortunately, and I'm sure, though, if you have specific questions for any of our panelists, they'd be more than happy to try and address them. But let's close by thanking them again.